As soon as our caravan had crossed the causeway and pulled into the central courtyard of Adbar Seged, Masara was whisked away by her female jailers into the labyrinth of stone passageways, and I was led to my new quarters, which abutted those of Akun. I was allotted a single stone cell. It was dark and draughty. The open fireplace blackened the walls with soot and gave out little heat. Though I wore the woolen robes of the land, I was never warm in Adbar Seged. How I longed for the sunlight on the Nile and the bright oasis of my very Egypt! I sat on those windswept battlements and pined for my family, for Memnon and Tanus, for my little princesses, but most of all for my mistress. Sometimes I woke in the night with the tears chilling my face, and I had to cover my head with my sheepskin blanket so that Akun would not hear my sobs through the thick stone wall. Often I pleaded with him to release me. "But why do you want to leave me, Taita? I want to go back to my family." "I am your family now," he laughed. "I am your father." I made a wager with him. If I won 100 successive boards of dom from him, he agreed that he would let me go and give me an escort back down the Nile to the Great Plains. When I won the 100th game, he chuckled and shook his head at my naivety. "Did I say 100? I think not. Surely it was 1,000. He turned to his henchmen. "Was the bargain 1,000? 1,000, they chanted. "It was 1,000. They all thought it was a grand joke. When, in a pique, I refused to play another board with Akun, he hung me naked from the walls of the citadel by my heels until I squealed for him to set up the board. When Akun saw me naked, he laughed and prodded me. "You may have a way with the dom board, but it seems you have lost your own stones, Egyptian." This was the first time since my capture that my physical mutilation had been revealed. Once again, men called me eunuch, much to my shame and mortification. However, in the end, the consequences were beneficial. If I had been a man in Tyre, they would never have let me go to Masara. They came for me in the night and led me shivering through the passages to Masara's cell. The room was lit by a dim oil lamp and smelled of vomit. The girl was curled on a straw mattress in the centre of the floor, with her vomit puddled on the stone floor beside her. She was in terrible pain, groaning and weeping and holding her stomach. I set to work immediately and examined her carefully. I was afraid that I would find her stomach as hard as a stone, the symptom of the swelling and bursting of the gut that would drench her insides with the contents of her intestines. There was no remedy for this condition. Not even I, with all my skills, could save her, if this was her affliction. To my great relief, I found her stomach warm and soft. There was no fever in her blood. I continued my examination, and though she groaned and screamed with agony when I touched her, I could not find any cause for her condition. I was puzzled, and I sat back to think about it. Then I realized that although her face was contorted with agony, she was watching me with a candid gaze. "This is worse than I feared," I turned to her two female attendants and spoke in Guise. "If I am to save her, I must have my chest. Fetch it immediately." They scrambled for the door, and I lowered my head to hers and whispered, "You are a clever girl and a good actress. Did you tickle your throat with a feather?" She smiled up at me and whispered back, "I could think of no other way to meet you. When the women told me that you had learned to speak Guise, I knew that we could help each other. I hope that is possible. I have been so lonely. Even to speak to a friend will be a joy to me." Her trust was so spontaneous that I was touched. "Perhaps between us we will find a way to escape from this dreadful place." At that moment, we heard the women returning, their voices echoing along the outside passage. Masara seized my hand. "You are my friend, aren't you? You will come to me again." "I am, and I will." "Quickly, tell me before you must go. What was his name?"
"Who?"
"The one who was with you on that first day beside the river. The one who looks like a young god."
"His name is Memnon."
"Memnon." She repeated it with a peculiar reverence. "It is a beautiful name. It suits him." The women burst into the room, and Masara clutched her healthy little belly and groaned as though she were at the point of death. While I clucked and shook my head with worry for the benefit of her women, I mixed a tonic of herbs that would do her some good and told them that I would return in the morning. In the morning, Masara's condition had improved, and I was able to spend a little longer with her. Only one of the women was present, and she soon became bored and wandered away to the far side of the room. Masara and I exchanged a few quiet words. Memnon said something to me I could not understand. What was it he said? He said, "I will come back for you. Be brave. I will come back for you." He could not mean that. He does not know me. He had met me only fleetingly. She shook her head, and tears filled her eyes. "Do you think he meant it, Taita?" There was a haunting plea in her tone that moved me, and I could not allow her to suffer more than she had already. "He is Crown Prince of Egypt, and a man of honour. Memnon would not have said it unless he meant every word." That was all we could say then, but I came back the next day. The very first thing she asked of me was, "Tell me again what Memnon said to me," and I had to repeat his promise. I told Akun that Masara was improving in health, but that she must be allowed out each day to walk on the battlements. "Otherwise I cannot answer for her health." He thought about that for a day. However, Masara was a valuable asset for which he had paid a horse load of silver bars, and at last he gave his permission. Our daily exercise period slowly extended, as the guards became accustomed to seeing us together. In the end, Masara and I were able to spend most mornings in each other's company, strolling around the walls of Adbar Serged and talking endlessly. Masara wanted to know everything that I had to tell about Memnon, and I racked my memory for anecdotes about him to entertain her. She had favourite stories which I was obliged to repeat until she knew them by heart, and she corrected me when I erred in the retelling. She particularly enjoyed the account of how he had rescued Tanus and me from the wounded bull elephant, and how he had received the gold of valour for his deed. "Tell me about his mother, the queen," she demanded, "and then tell me about Egypt. Tell me about your gods. Tell me about when Memnon was a baby." Always her questions returned to him, and I was glad to appease her demands, for I longed for my family. Speaking about them made them seem closer to me. One morning she came to me distraught. "Last night I had a dreadful dream. I dreamed that Memnon came back to me, but I could not understand what he said to me. You must teach me to speak Egyptian, Taita. We will start today, this very minute." She was desperate to learn, and she was a clever little thing. It went very quickly. Soon we were talking only Egyptian between ourselves, and it was useful to be able to speak privately in front of her guards. When we were not talking about Memnon, we were discussing our plans to escape. Of course, I had been thinking of this ever since our arrival at Adbar Serged, but it helped to have her thoughts on the same subject to compare with my own. "Even if you escape from this fortress, you will never pass through the mountains without help," she warned me. "The paths are like a skein of twisted wool. You will never unravel them. Every clan is at war with the next. They trust no strangers, and they will cut your throat as a spy." "What must we do, then?" I asked. "If you are able to get away, you must go to my father. He will protect you and guide you back to your own people. You will tell Memnon where I am, and he will come to save me." She said this with such shining confidence that I could not meet her eyes. I realized then that Masara had built up an image of Memnon in her mind that was not based on reality. She was in love with a god, not a stripling, as young and untried as she was herself. I was responsible for this, with my clever stories about the prince. I could not wound her now and shatter her hope by telling her how forlorn all these imaginings truly were. "If I go to Prester Benijon, your father, he will think I am one of Akun's spies. He will have my head," I tried to extricate myself from the responsibilities she had laid upon me. "I will tell you what to say to him. Things that only he and I know. That will prove to him that you come from me." She had blocked me there, so I tried a different escape. "How would I find my way to your father's fortress? You have told me that the path is a tangled net." "I will explain the way to you, because you are so clever you will remember everything I tell you." By this time, naturally, I loved her almost as much as I loved my own little princesses. I would take any risk to shield her from hurt. She reminded me so strongly of my mistress at the same age that I could deny her nothing. "Very well, tell it to me." And so we began to plan our escape. It was a game for me, which I played mostly to keep her hopes alive and her spirits buoyant. I had no serious expectation of finding a way off this pinnacle of rock. We discussed ways of making a rope to lower ourselves down the cliff, although every time I looked over the causeway from the terrace outside her cell, I shuddered at that gaping void of space. She began to collect scraps of wool and cloth that she hid under her mattress. From these she planned to plait a rope. I could not tell her that a rope long enough and strong enough to support our weight and take us down to the floor of the valley would fill her cell to the ceiling. For 2 long years we languished on the height of Adbar Seged, and we never were able to devise a plan of escape. But Massara never lost faith. Every day she asked me, "What did Memnon say to me? Tell me again what he promised." "He said, 'I will come back for you. Be brave.'" "Yes, I am brave, am I not, Taita?" "You are the bravest girl I know." "Tell me what you will say to my father when you meet him." I repeated her instructions, and then she would reveal to me her latest plan of escape. "I will catch the little sparrows that I feed on the terrace. You will write a letter to my father to tell him where I am. We will tie it to the sparrow's leg, and it will fly to him." "It is more likely to fly to Akun, who will have us both thrashed, and we will not be allowed to see each other again." In the end, I escaped from Adbar Seged by riding out on a fine horse. Akun was going on another raid against King Prester Beni John. I was commanded to accompany him in the capacity of personal physician and dom player. As I walked my blindfolded horse across the causeway, I looked back and saw Massara standing on her terrace looking down at me. She was a lovely, lonely figure. She called to me in Egyptian. I could just make out her words above the sigh of the wind. "Tell him I am waiting for him. Tell him I have been brave." And then softly, so I was not certain that I had heard the words right, "Tell him I love him." The wind turned the tears upon my cheeks as cold as ice as I rode away across Amba Kamara. The night before the battle, Akun kept me sitting late in his tent. While he gave his last orders to his commanders, he stropped the edge of the blue sword. Once in a while he would shave a few hairs off his wrist with the steely glittering blade to test the edge, and nod with satisfaction. At last he rubbed down the blade with clarified mutton fat. The strange silver-blue metal had to be kept well greased, otherwise a red powder would form upon it, almost as though it was bleeding. The blue sword had come to exert the same fascination on me as it had on Tanos. Occasionally, when he was in a specially benevolent mood, Akun would allow me to handle it. The weight of the metal was surprising, and the sharpness of the edge was incredible. I imagined what havoc it could wreak in the hands of a swordsman like Tanos. I knew that if we ever met again, Tanos would want every detail of it, and so I questioned Akun, who never tired of boasting about it. He told me that the sword had been forged in the heart of a volcano by one of the pagan gods of Ethiopia. Akun's great-grandfather had won it from the god in a game of dom that had lasted for 20 days and 20 nights. I found all this quite plausible, except the part of the legend about winning the weapon in a dom game. If Akun's great-grandfather had played dom at the same standard as Akun, then it must have been a very stupid god who lost the sword to him. Akun asked my opinion of his battle plan for the next day. He had learned that I was a student of military tactics. I told him his plan was brilliant. These Ethiopians had as much grasp of military tactics as they had of the play of the dom stones. Of course, the terrain would not allow full use of the horses, and they had no chariots. Nevertheless, their battles were fought in a haphazard and desultory manner.